Technology. It's such a big part of our lives. It can be fun. It can be convenient, just like this podcast, which is why University of Missouri Healthcare is proud to support podcasting on KBIA. Technology can also save your life. That's why so many people turn to University of Missouri Healthcare. Its hospitals and clinics offer you the latest technology, plus a medical team whose skill and knowledge are unparalleled. You know technology makes everyday life a lot better. Well, it's true for your healthcare, too. University of Missouri Healthcare, the care you deserve from the team you trust.
Hello, and welcome to Under the Microscope, KBIA's weekly look into stories in science, health, and technology. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Ethanol is an up-and-down industry, and right now, it's down. Ethanol plants in at least 13 states have temporarily closed in recent months because of higher corn prices and lower demand for ethanol. The industry is trying to change the equation by putting more of the biofuel in gasoline. But as Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports, ethanol critics are pushing back.
Semis roll down Highway 20 just outside of the small town of Atkinson in north-central Nebraska. They're pulling trailers full of corn and rolling right past Nedac Ethanol, a plant built by local investors in 2008. Jerome Fagerland is Nedac's president and general manager.
We had corn coming in as far as 130 miles out.
So it's been pretty quiet around here since June.
Absolutely.
There are no trucks crossing the scales. Towering steel grain bins sit empty. And it is quiet. The Nedac plant has been closed since last summer, when the drought pushed corn prices to new highs. But in his office, Fagerland says corn prices are not the whole story.
We definitely, as an industry, have an ability to produce more than what our domestic demand is at this time.
30 or so of the nation's 211 ethanol plants have gone idle over the past several months. It's a sign that ethanol has run into the so-called blend wall, which means the U.S. is making more ethanol than can actually be used in the fuel supply. When you see ethanol at the pump, it's usually a 10% blend called E10. But at that rate, it's impossible to meet the government's growing ethanol mandate. Bob Dineen of the Renewable Fuels Association says moving up to 15%, or E15, would push the industry beyond the blend wall.
Sure, you'd have another 6 or 7 billion gallons of ethanol demand. So, you know, clearly you would be able to restart the 2 billion gallons of capacity that is currently not being utilized, and there'd be room for growth.
The Environmental Protection Agency gave E15 the green light last year, but you probably haven't noticed. It's only available at a handful of stations in Corn Belt states like Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, and Kansas. With no room for more ethanol in the market, prices fall and plants shut down. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., E15 is running into roadblocks.
Allowing the sale of E15 at this point in time is premature and irresponsible.
That's Robert Darbonnet of the travel group AAA testifying before a House subcommittee. Based on government research, EPA approved E15 only for cars and trucks made in the year 2001 or later. But Darbonnet told lawmakers that industry-funded research shows some approved cars are still open to damage.
Virtually every OEM or auto manufacturer in this country, virtually all of the OEMs have said, do not put this fuel in your tank unless you are accepting of the fact that it will void your warranty.
AAA supports a proposal to require more research on E15. Other bills in Congress would block E15 or cut back the renewable fuel standard. Bob Dineen at the Renewable Fuels Association calls the debate over E15 marketplace politics, as the government forces oil companies to hand a larger share of the fuel market over to ethanol. Ultimately, he says, ethanol still has political support where it counts, in the Senate and the White House.
And they're not going to roll back this important program, period.
Back in Atkinson, Nebraska, Nedac Ethanol is not just on standby, it's for sale. Jerome Fagerland says the plant went into foreclosure in January, and the creditors are looking for new owners.
You know, the facility runs, it's fairly efficient, it needs to be a producing plant.
Fagerland believes there's still a place in the industry for ethanol from Atkinson, but like other idle ethanol producers, it may have to wait for a break in the drought and a breakthrough at the pump. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Owning a dog could have positive effects on children with autism. That's according to two studies from the University of Missouri. The studies used surveys to gauge the impact of dog ownership on children and their families. Rebecca Johnson is the director of the MU Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction and was one of the researchers involved with the studies. I spoke to Johnson, along with Gretchen Carlisle, a former doctoral student in the School of Nursing who wrote her dissertation on the subject. Johnson started by telling me about some of the physical benefits of dog ownership.
There's a sound body of research demonstrating that various beneficial neurohormones are released when a person interacts calmly with a companion animal. So when you're petting a dog or a cat, there is a release of oxytocin, which is a very beneficial hormone for producing feelings of well-being and happiness. And we know that the nervous system calms down so that the child and or any person, in fact, relaxes while having that happen. Their blood pressure decreases and their heart rate and respiratory rate decrease in response to these neurohormone releases. The stress hormone cortisol also decreases. So if you're stressed and anxious, the cortisol decreasing will help to alleviate those feelings.
I guess outside of like the actual data you were looking at, how did the two studies differ?
The web-based study was looking predominantly at information from the parents. However, Dr. Carlisle's study also surveyed the children. And that makes it a very unique study indeed, because autistic children are generally not surveyed or not included in research. So her work points out the importance and the reliability of including the children in such a survey, that they in fact can complete instruments reliably and that they can participate in an interview and provide a lot of very useful information.
What's the takeaway for someone that's not in academia, either a clinician or a...
So one of the things that the children said was that they described themselves as being more strongly attached to small dogs. So that would certainly be something for consideration. Another issue to consider is that within many of the families, both that did not own dogs and those that did, the parents described sensory issues that their children would have, maybe being overly sensitive to a dog if it was barking loudly or had overly exuberant behavior, and that had created a problem with the relationship.
Do you think that these benefits would also extend beyond just dogs? Would other companion animals also exhibit similar effects?
As I said earlier, in fact, the statistically significant difference in this study was actually children that had pets versus no pet at all. And so, in fact, I do believe that there may be benefits from alternative types of pets. Two of the children in my study had rabbits that they had a very close relationship with, and other children that had cats that they had a close relationship with.
And that'll do it for this week's Under the Microscope. To listen to this episode again, just visit our website, kbia.org. I'm Raymond Tongakar. Thanks for listening.